Let's get started. So today we're going to sort of continue talking about these generalized Penrose processes, these ways of extracting energy from rotating black holes, but focus on some particular cases, and mainly one called super radiance, which is sort of the wave version of the story of extracting energy from rotating black holes. And so I'm going to talk a little bit about super radiance and some situations in which super radiance might actually give rise to an instability. And then for sort of the last half of the class, I'm actually going to just show you some sort of very brief highlights from some sort of research applications of super radiance and these related ideas from various researchers at PI. And this will also sort of be a nice segue into next week. So all the stuff I'm going to present are sort of from performing nonlinear evolutions of the GR equations. So, you know, sort of in this class so far, we've been just thinking about Einstein's equations as a, some condition on the geometry of our four-dimensional space-time manifolds. But starting next week, we're going to sort of think of it more as some sort of evolution equations that allow us to, start with some geometry and then evolve forward to find some geometry at some later time. Yeah, so yesterday we talked about these generalized Penrose processes. And we showed in particular that if we look at any sort of stress energy tensor and calculate the flux across the black hole horizon, if it satisfies this null energy condition, we should get something like this relation for the amount of energy with respect to this Killing vector across the Harker black hole horizon and the amount of angular momentum, which is exactly the condition such that the black hole's horizon the area of the black hole's horizon will actually increase. Yeah, so today I want to talk about super radiance. So this is sort of the wave version of the Penrose process. So to look at super radiance, let's first consider the simplest kind of wave we can have, which is just a scalar field. So just a massless scalar field. So it satisfies the massless Klein-Gordon equation. And that's just that box of psi, which is just two covariant derivatives contracted with each other, is equal to zero. So of course, in flat space time, this would just be the ordinary wave operator. But now we want to consider this. Yeah?
Something related still to the Penrose process is, I was thinking about the Hawking-Bekenstein evaporation process. Is it, does it go against the Yarrell law? Because it's a quantum process, or still satisfies. Because by the evaporation process, you decrease the mass of the black hole. So, speak for a second.
So in some sense, if we want to go to sort of a generalized, if we want to sort of go into thinking about black holes in the way Hawking was, we should just think of not the Airy law, but just the second law of thermodynamics. And classically, nothing's going to escape from the black hole, so its entropy is always going to increase. But if it can emit some sort of radiation or something like that, then we have to take into account the entropy in both of those together.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, but that's going a little bit beyond the purview of this class. So all those, the black hole laws of thermodynamics, so they're sort of what people were using to sort of start to think about, quantum effects of black holes and so on. the ones as I presented them, they're just sort of things you can derive from classical GR without adding quantum effects. Thanks. Yeah, so the equation of motion for the wave is just box of psi equals zero, and its stress energy tensor is given by this. So basically what we want to do is imagine we have some solution of the following form. Basically imagine we can separate our solution so into a part that just depends on the radius and theta coordinate, and then basically imagine we have a wave of some pure frequency omega, and then m is the so-called azimuthal number. Which determines sort of the axial symmetry. And here I just mean the real part, so just the cosine. Yeah, so basically what we want to do is plug in these expressions into the equation we had before for the flux of energy across a black hole horizon. So some integral over time, and then we're evaluating at the horizon, and then we contract our stress energy tensor with this normal vector to the horizon, and with our time-killing vector, which basically gives us the conserved current associated with this wave, we can kind of think of as a particle number, like a flux of particles. And so just integrate this over the surface of the black hole horizon at some time. Yeah, so let's plug in this expression here. And so this term actually vanishes. So if you'll recall, for example, like there's many ways to see this, but for example, you know, we wrote recall this is the definition of this vector chi. So for example, we can write this as where this is zero, and then we exactly define this quantity, the horizon velocity, by contracting with here and then it go to zero. So this guy is zero. And so we just have this term right here, and then we can use this ansatz here to evaluate it. So we basically, from this time component contracted here, we get a frequency, and then from this part, we get minus m times omega h. Actually, let me. Okay, so just contracting here and here, and then using that expression to evaluate this. So we can note that this part is always going to be greater than or equal to 0. So basically, the condition on whether or not the flux of the Killian energy into the black hole horizon is positive or negative is just depends on the sign of this thing. So in particular, you know, if we just take the convention that our frequency is positive, you can write it like this. So when we have, when this condition is true, then we have a negative flux of energy into the black hole. So this is called the super radiance condition. So you can see that, you know, generically you think of if you have some wave with some frequency, you send it in towards a black hole. You know, some of it will get absorbed by the black hole, and some will get scattered. But if you have a spinning black hole and a wave with this in this frequency range, then it could actually be so-called super radiantly scattered. It can actually be reflected with more energy than the incoming wave. And we could have probably guessed this immediately just from using the first expression I wrote down for a generalized Penrose process. If we, you know, just remember that basically, if we have some wave packet, the ratio of energy and angular momentum carried by that is just given by this ratio of the frequency to the azimuth number. So this condition is the same as the first one I wrote down over there with this identification. So you can see from here, that sort of the super radiance turns off in two limits. You know, one is as the frequency approaches this sort of horizon frequency of the black hole times the azimuthal number n, and then also it also will go to zero as omega goes to zero. And you can think of that limit as the limit where basically the wavelength of our wave is very long compared to the size of our black hole horizon. So basically, the wave just sort of doesn't feel the black hole, and it just scattered without sort of being without much flux across the horizon. So we just derived it here for the scalar case, but it's actually quite a general phenomena. So it can occur for electromagnetic waves, and it can even occur for gravitational waves. So this whole analysis, you know, we relied on having a stress energy tensor, so it isn't technically applicable to the gravitational wave case. But you can, you know, sort of construct a gauge-dependent sort of effective stress energy tensor for gravitational waves and carry out an analysis sort of like this. Or you can just solve the linear perturbation equations on Kerr spacetime. And so not surprisingly, if you look at super radiance as a function of spin, it's sort of maximized for maximally spinning black holes. But it also turns out the sort of maximum amplification you could get, that is, you know, if you send a wave with some energy E, then you get back energy E, times 1 plus some amplification factor. That actually depends on the spin of the wave. So, for the scalar case, that's spin zero. Actually, turns out the max amplification is pretty small. It's about 0.3%. Well, for spin one, that's electromagnetic waves. It can go up to 4.4%. And then for gravitational waves, it's 138%. So this is the maximum which occurs for maxly spinning. So to actually derive these, you need to sort of solve what are called the Tucholsky equations. And so we'll talk a little bit about those in week three, but those are basically govern TUS fields or linear perturbations to the metric on a Kerr spacetime. And it actually turns out that in general, the equations do separate into this nice form, and you can actually separate the radial and theta components as well. So to actually determine those radial and theta dependents, and therefore calculate, you know, things like this, you have to solve those equations.
Is there any difference on the maximum amplification for if you have, for example, a massive scalar or a massive electromagnetic-like field? I mean, will that?
The difference is not so much on the
amplification. They go back and move.
So we'll talk about the difference is mainly that they can form bound states or not. So these amplifications are basically you take some wave, you send it in, and then it's going to reflect back out and go back out to infinity. Yeah, so we'll talk about what happens when you have massive bosons. Yeah, so that's sort of brings me to the next point. So as we just mentioned, for all these cases, for photons or gravitational waves or massless scalars, you can superradially scatter them, maybe get some energy out of a black hole, but you're not going to get sort of any instability or things like that. And in reality, it'd be very hard to astrophysically arrange to have some wave that sort of, starts off in some shell or something and is incident upon a black hole and then gets reflected back or something like that. One idea for sort of making this into an instability is to take your black hole and surround it by a mirror. So if you had a mirror, then you could send in some wave with the right superradiant frequency, and you get reflected back with some amplification, and you can reflect again be superradiantly scattered. And since, each time you get amplification that's proportional to the amount of energy this wave is bringing in, this would actually give you an exponential instability. This idea was actually due to Preston Tucholsky. And they call this a black hole bomb. We don't know of any big mirrors we can put around black holes. So, just as stated, this doesn't seem like a very realistic idea. But there are a couple ways you might get something like a mirror. So the first one is to consider anti-de Sitter space. So, We don't think we live in anti-de-Sitter space, but this is something people are interested in, for example, in the ADS-CFT correspondence or things like that. And the interesting thing about anti-de-Sitter space is that you have a time-like boundary. So if you have a, this is sort of the exterior of anti-de-Sitter space where sort of infinity corresponds to a time-like boundary, and then you would have your black hole horizon here, and you have to impose some boundary conditions, but sort of the most natural ones are essentially like reflecting boundary conditions, so that you sort of keep a constant amount of energy in your space-time. And in that case, you know, you can have waves that would sort of bounce back and forth, and in fact, it turns out that you can get a super radiant instability in anti-de-Sitter space this way. And in fact, black holes with ergo regions in anti-de-Sitter space are generically unstable. Yeah, and you can get a similar story. So far I've just been talking about rotating black holes, but you can also have charged black holes. And then again, there'll be a difference between sort of their total mass and their irreducible mass, which you calculate from their area due to the basically the energy that's stored in their electromagnetic fields. So again, it's possible if you have a charged particle to extract that energy. And so you can sort of define a generalized ergo region for charged black holes. So if you have some particle, then basically the killing energy, again, you get by contracting your killing vector with four momentum. But in addition to the part just due to the four velocity times the mass, there'll also be a part due to the charge, if the particle is charged. And that'll just be given by the killing vector contracted with the vector four potential associated with the black hole. So if you can basically arrange for this to be negative, we can define a effective ergosphere for that particular charge. And then you basically get a very similar story. Yeah, and so the story about ADS spacetimes or charged black holes is sort of more for this ADS-CFT correspondence or sort of more theoretical application. So probably the most astrophysically relevant version of this Penrose process story is the Blanford's and Knight process. So I mentioned that briefly yesterday. But the idea is basically that you have a black hole, and away from the black hole, you have some accretion disk where you have basically baryons that can source some magnetic field and basically hold magnetic field lines in the vicinity of the black hole. And if we sort of zoom in close to the black hole, we can think of this dipole configuration as mainly giving approximately straight field lines. But basically, the black hole's rotation will cause these field lines to rotate and therefore give you a pointy flux of energy that will carry away rotational energy from the black hole, and we think this is what powers jets. Yeah, so being very sort of sketchy with all these examples, but we'll, this is just to sort of introduce the concepts, and then I'll show you some, sort of briefly, some research results from all these different things. Okay, so we just talked about super radiance for massless bosons. But Ramiro was asking about the case of where you have a massive boson. So, and how does that change things? So let's consider a massive scalar field. So again, we get the Klein-Gorn equation. But here we have this extra term, which I'll call mu squared, but which is basically just the mass of the boson up to some factor of h bar. But sort of in the units, relativists like to use the scalar field is actually dimensionless, and then we just have, you know, units of 1 over length squared here, and mu corresponds to a unit of 1 over length. So just to make things simple, let's concentrate on the sort of non-relativistic limit, where basically assume the sort of Compton wavelength, sort of effective Compton wavelength of our scalar field, which is just given by 1 over mu, is much bigger than the size of the black hole we're considering. And also that our field is basically far away from the black hole. So basically, so we're considering sort of the non-relativistic limit. So if we just write out this equation, so this is just two covariant derivatives contracted with each other. And the first one is just ordinary derivative because it's acting on a scalar. And then we can use this handy identity that basically we can exchange this for an ordinary derivative with these factors of the square root of the negative determinant of the metric. So in particular, since we're far away from the black hole, for this analysis, we can just ignore the spin of the black hole. And you know, when you're far away from the black hole, you just feel its mass, and the spin falls off more rapidly. So symmetric term is just given by this term, and we can simplify this as the following. Schwarzschild, this inverse metric GTT component is approximately given by this. And you know, generically, I would have had other terms that were this Laplacian multiplied by like M over R or something like that. But I'm basically assuming that scalar field is non-relativistic, so basically its momentum is much less than its frequency. And so basically I just need to keep the you know, leading order corrections due to the gravitational potential for the time components. So if we use the following ansatz, basically, again, just plug in solution at some fixed frequency. And note that, again, because we're considering non-relativistic limit, this frequency is going to be approximately just given by sort of the mass of the particle with some small non-relativistic correction. So if we plug this in, we get the following, and just collecting some terms. And then we're going to use this approximation basically to say that we have one of these omega minus mu's and set it to be okay, yeah, so just took this omega plus mu is approximately a 2 mu and then divided it by the other side. And so at the end, we get something given by this. And this equation probably looks familiar from other classes, right? So this is really just the Schrödinger equation, time-independent Schrödinger equation for a hydrogen atom, right? We just have to make some identification. So basically, here our fine structure constant is going to be this term right here, mu times the mass of the black hole. And you know, our energy is given by this term. And you know, sort of our effective Bohr radius. It's just given by that. And you know, no, we didn't actually use any quantum mechanics. We're just starting from the classical wave equation and making this non-relativistic limit. But you know, since we've all spent so much time solving this equation, we can sort of know immediately that you know, we can get this whole set of sort of bound states that we can you know, label by some quote unquote quantum numbers given by n, which counts the number of radial nodes in our solution, some L and M Engler quantum numbers. Basically just determine the theta and phi dependence of our solution. And so Yeah, so the point is, you know, for example, if we look at L equals m equals 1, we know that we're going to get some solution that sort of, you know, falls off exponentially with distance, and there'll be some sort of spherical harmonic type term. And then it'll oscillate with some frequency. And this mu here will be a complex number in general. It'll be the real part will be the magnitude of the real part will be much greater than the imaginary part. And it'll be approximately mu, and then there'll be basically some correction, which will, because this particle is slightly bound to our black hole, so it has sort of negative potential energy. But it'll also have some imaginary part, and that's just due to the fact that, you know, we sort of zoomed out, but we have to remember that we have a black hole horizon at the middle, so there'll actually be some flux of energy across the black hole horizon. And, you know, if the frequency of our bound state is less than m times mega h, then we can again have super radiance. But instead of just having, you know, a wave that is scattered by the black hole, we can have these bound states that just sit around the black hole and continuously interact and grow through super radiance. So we can actually get exponentially growing mode. Yeah, so for this this growth rate, this instability to be significant, we don't want alpha to be very, very small. Or equivalently, we sort of want omega to be somewhat comparable to omega h, the rise in frequency of the black hole. So basically, this super radiant instability will be, so if we just sort of restore units to all this, we can rewrite this alpha as something like this. So this is the mass of our boson. So you can see that when it's we have a black hole that's sort of stellar mass, you know, 10 to the 10 solar masses or so, then we want the mass of this boson to be somewhere in the range of 10 to the minus 12 electron volts. So these are very ultralight bosons that would be relevant for having a super radiant stability around astrophysical black holes. And of course, we don't know of any such ultralight bosons in the standard model. They're all much more massive. But particle physicists have speculated about a number of such candidates and extensions to the standard model, things like the axion or dark photons or things like that, where you would actually have these very ultralight bosons. And they may be very weakly coupled to standard model particles, which is why we don't find them in colliders or things like that. They may be some sort of dark matter. But the super radiant stability actually doesn't rely on any sort of coupling to ordinary matter. All we're relying on is that they gravitate, just like we think all other matter does. And you can get a similar story for vector bosons as well as scalar bosons. And in fact, the instability rates are higher, related to the fact that, it's underneath this board, the fact that, you know, if you just look at the scattering case, the amplification factor is larger for vectors as opposed to scalars. So any questions about that?
Is there any, because at some point...
Can we lower the projector?
I think they do it.
Yeah.
Like a person.
Yeah, I was talking to...
Oh.
Yeah, can we lower the projector now? Thanks.
When does like the back reaction start being important into this, and could that like somehow like stop the instability?
Yeah, so actually that's exactly what we're going to talk about here. So very good question. You know, whenever we have an instability, we want to ask, you know, once this thing grows large enough, what's gonna be the nonlinear behavior? What's gonna cause it to saturate? Any other questions before we go on to this? Yeah, so just in the last 15 or 20 minutes, just want to briefly talk about some results from the nonlinear regime of superradiants. So this is research by various friends at PI. So first of all, just as a warm-up, we talked about this Blanford Zanayak process for powering jets. So just to give you a more concrete example of this, this is a particular realization of this Blanford Zanayak process in the case where you just have a uniform magnetic field and then a spinning black hole. It's immersed in this uniform magnetic field. This is something Romero knows a whole lot about. So the magnetic field lines you get. So you find a stationary solution once you allow this to relax. And you have magnetic field lines. Far away, they're just straight. And then close by, they thread the black hole. You get some electric field here. And if you measure basically the rotational velocity of these field lines, which you can define in a particular way, this axisymmetric space-time, and plot them basically as a function of the flux, you get the curves like this. So this is basically just telling you, as we look at these different field lines in our jet solution, how fast are they rotating? And you can see we've normalized by the rise in frequency of the black hole. These cases just correspond to different spins of the black hole. You can see basically they're all right below this bound that we wrote down that allows you to extract energy from the black hole. So basically the black hole is causing these field lines to rotate. And if you measure the pointy flux, the energy radiated by this electromagnetic field far away, you can get positive energy. And this plot just shows that, again, as you increase the spin of the black hole, the amount of energy you can extract increases. And here, this is showing basically two different ways of calculating, or two different energy densities within the vicinity of the black hole. And this dotted red line corresponds to the Ergo region. You know, you'll recall that the energy density seen by some observer, to calculate that, we just take the stress energy tensor and contract it with the forward velocity of our observer. So this first one is just this quantity, and where you take this our observer to be the one that's basically perpendicular to our slices of constant time. But that's not actually the one that's conserved, right? So the conserved current, you remember, is given by contracting this with a time-like Killing vector, and then then you can also calculate the sort of conserved energy that observer that is again perpendicular to slices of constant time observes, and then we get something like this. We can see that, in fact, it's going negative because we're in the Ergo region, so our time Killing vector is actually becoming space-like. So that's the Blanford-Zanayak process. So here is just superradiance
superradiant scattering of a gravitational wave. So we have a spinning black hole here at the middle, and then we're going to have an incoming wave, blue, and it's going to be scattered and create this outgoing gravitational wave, and red. And you can see it's actually a very strong gravitational wave, has something like 10% of the mass of the black hole. So it distorts the horizon, and it creates this outgoing wave. And this is actually a full nonlinear solution to the TR equations.
What is the remaining stuff there?
So it's a little bit hard to define exactly what you mean by a gravitational wave in the vicinity of the black hole. So as a proxy for this, we're using something that we'll probably discuss in week 3. It's called this Newman-Penrose scalar Psi-4. So that encodes a gravitational wave sort of far away near the black hole. It's less clear what that means. So those are just the contours of that. Yeah. Yeah, so you can see that you extracted energy from the rotating black hole by comparing the amount of energy in the incoming wave to that of the outgoing wave. But you can also look at the properties of the black hole before and after. So we haven't really talked about how to define black holes in a dynamical setting. We'll get to that next week. You can do that using something called an apparent horizon. And if you basically look at the properties of that, you can first just look at its area and calculate an irreducible mass. And so this is comparing the irreducible mass sort of before and after for three different cases, where basically the blue case, the frequency is above the super radiant cutoff. The red case is where it's sort of very near to being exactly at the threshold for superradiance. And then the black curve is where it's below the superradiant bound, so we can actually extract energy. And so you can see that in all three cases, the area of our black hole is greater afterwards than before. However, if we look at the mass of the black hole or the angular momentum, we can see that for the case corresponding to the black crosses, the angular momentum and mass actually go down compared to the other two cases where this gravitational wave is mostly absorbed by the black hole. And you can actually see how the linear prediction begins to break down a little bit in the nonlinear regime. So this is basically showing you, as a function of the amount of energy that you're extracting from the black hole, what is sort of the efficiency of the process? That is, how much energy are you extracting from the black hole compared to how much rotational energy you're losing from the black hole? So basically, when this black hole undergoes this interaction, if you're in the superradiant regime, you'll extract some rotational energy, but the black hole area will also increase, so the irreducible mass will also increase. So that's energy that you can no longer get out. So it's sort of been lost. So you can see that in the nonlinear regime, at least for this particular case, the efficiency, nonlinear effects have caused the efficiency to be somewhat suppressed. And it's not that surprising if you think about it, because we have this big wave that's actually changing the properties of the black hole. Spinning it down somewhat as it's interacting with the wave. So it's somewhat, you can think of the final black hole as going to be less super radiantly efficient than the initial black hole. And so during this process, you expect the same thing to happen. You can also think of it as kind of like analogous to, the fact that, you have most thermodynamic efficiency when you sort of have a quasi-equilibrium process, and then when you have a very dynamical process that's happening very fast, you lose efficiency. Yeah, so now that was just regular superradiance. Now what about the superradiant instability? So this is some work that Pablo did along with Louise Lehner and Stephen Green, and they were interested in looking at a charged black hole in ABS and looking at the superradiance stability of a charged scalar field. So this animation here is going to show you this charged scalar field outside the black hole, and you have to notice that this label here is increasing, indicating that the scale is actually increasing. So initially you start with some arbitrary perturbation, and then it sort of starts to settle down as it this unstable mode rises up. You can see that the magnitude of this charged scalar field outside the black hole is increasing exponentially in time. And then eventually the time is still moving forward, but it's basically remaining the same because the instability has saturated. You can see that more easily on these plots here. So the top plot shows the apparent horizon radius as a function of time. So you can see that it's increasing exponentially and then it saturates. And on these two plots, you can see the black hole charge. So instead of angular momentum, we're extracting charge from the black hole. And that's given by this teal line. So it's decreasing and then it saturates. And that charge is going into the scalar field, which actually forms this sort of hair around the black hole in ADS. Yeah, so finally, let's go on to the case of a massive boson. So like we said, massive bosons can actually form these bound states around black holes, even in asymptotically flat settings. And when their Compton wavelength is comparable to the size of the black hole, you can actually get these clouds that grow exponentially in time. So here's an animation from a study of a massive vector field around a spinning black hole. So black holes spin, points in that direction, and this is the energy density in the massive vector field, and it grows exponentially with time, and then it'll eventually saturate. And you probably can't see it from that plot, but not only is the energy and angular momentum in the cloud growing exponentially in time, but the black hole spacetime is actually changing as well. So for these two figures, the blue curves tell you the energy and angular momentum in this cloud of vector bosons, and the dotted black curves show you the loss of the black hole's mass and angular momentum as a function of time. And these are for just different cases with different values of the vector boson mass, mu. And you can see that the black hole is losing quite a lot of mass in some cases, up to almost 10%, and up to 35% of its angular momentum. But it's eventually, at some point, this instability shuts off, and these curves are essentially constant. And so does anyone know why that's happening? So the reason the instability is shutting off is because as this black hole is losing energy and angular momentum, its horizon frequency, omega h, is actually decreasing. So you can see that in this plot here. Omega h is given by these blue curves. And basically the frequency of these vector bosons is given by the dashed red curves. So you can see that they're decreasing. As the black hole is spun down, and then they sort of smoothly approach the frequency given by the vector boson cloud. And so even though we have these huge clouds of something like 10% of the mass of the black hole oscillating very close to the horizon, and we're very much in the nonlinear regime, it seems like this is actually happens quasi-adiabatically, where just the black hole is going through a series of states that correspond approximately to spinning black curve solutions with different lower values of spin. And then eventually, as these two approach each other, our super radiance condition is saturated and we no longer get an instability. Yeah, so these are exciting because when you have these oscillating clouds sitting around black holes, they will actually produce gravitational waves. And so basically, the gravitational waves are pretty simple. They're actually a sort of monochromatic. The frequency is more or less constant and is just given by twice the oscillation frequency of this cloud. And then the amplitude of it will slowly decrease as the cloud loses energy to gravitational waves. So this is something that people at LIGO and other gravitational wave instruments are very much interested in looking for. You can either look for a stochastic background of these gravitational waves coming from a whole ensemble of spinning black holes that are being spun down due to this instability, or you can even do targeted searches. So for example, a very good way to create a spinning black hole is to merge two black holes together. So, when LIGO sees a black hole merger, it can potentially do a follow-up observation to look for some continuous source of gravitational waves coming from that newborn spinning black hole. And, we could use this to look for these new particles.
How long would these emissions last after a merger?
It can vary a lot. For these very relativistic cases, the one shown here, it can be as short as hours, but generic, these can be much longer than that. It can be weeks or months or even longer. But yeah, basically the smaller this alpha parameter is that I wrote down, which is basically tells you how far the cloud sits away from the black hole and how big the Compton wavelength of the particle is compared to the black hole mass. The bigger you make that, the sort of longer it takes for these to grow and the longer it takes for them to dissipate. Yep. And finally, besides looking for gravitational waves, you can also just measure black hole spins. And every time you measure a black hole to have a spin of, and you know that it's existed long enough where if you had one of these particles it would have been spun down by this instability, you can basically rule out having a massive boson in that given range. So this just illustrates it by saying, let's say we start with an ensemble of black holes that have mass given by the x-axis here and then spin given by the y-axis there, and then we subject them to massive boson with a given mass, then that'll cause some range of these to be unstable and to spin down, and then we'll get the actual distribution of mass spin will be something like this. We get these different parts carved out. And you can measure spins either from gravitational waves or by using these X-ray observations of accreting black holes or things like that. Yeah, so that's all I wanted to say for today. So are there any questions about that? Or anything else?
What are the spins that LIGO has measured for black holes after the merger? Until now, are they're not really high, right?
The spin of the final black hole?
Final black hole.
If you take two non-spinning black holes and you merge them, they have a spin of about 0.7. That's basically just from the orbital angular momentum sort of at the last plunge phase when they are very rapidly forming a common horizon. So I think most black holes at least are to within the range that we can tell the final black hole has that spin.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's said another way, except for maybe one case, we haven't been able to rule out that the black holes are non-spinning, the ones that are coming together to merge, so there's no extra angular momentum.
And that's the weird part, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so depending on your favorite model for creating black holes, yeah, you may preferentially have spin or not. And so, yeah, so it's kind of strange that so far most of them seem to be non-spinning. Any other questions? Okay, so I will see y'all on Monday.